What's bigger than a shrew and smaller than a squirrel? It's not a riddle for the research team, but rather part of the answer to a question they explored. With the various placentals alive today, from animals that walk or fly or swim, and of course humans, what could the common ancestor possibly look like? Dr. Michelle Spaulding from the Carnegie Museum of Natural History is a co-author of the study.
What I was interested in was trying to figure out where a lot of fossil mammals that we have known for a very long time, but we don't really know what their living relative is, because it's one of those things where you really need to know where all the phylogeny of all living mammals before you can start looking at these. Because it's not like some studies where you can say, okay, I have this animal, and I can tell that this is related to dogs or cats. So I'm going to make a study where I look at dogs and cats and their relatives and easily place it within there. We have some animals that are just so bizarre, like some of these South American ungulates, hooved mammals called nutto ungulates, that have literally been put throughout the tree. Like, you can, any living animal you can think of, someone's said they're related to it at some point in time. What also came out of the project was to be able to actually reconstruct what the ancestor of all placental mammals could have looked like.
You looked at the evolution of placental mammals, 5,100 living species, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you studied, was it 83?
Yeah, we had 83, and that's living and extant. So what we did is we sampled at least one animal from every order.
The study combines two disciplines, DNA, molecular, mm-hmm. and morphological. What can each tell researchers, and what were the shortcomings of each approach?
We get a different tree if we just run the molecules or if we just run the morphology. There are exceptions, but for the most part, the tree of living mammals is, when we combine them, is more like the molecular result. Now, why is that? Well, it's because when we look at living mammals, we can only see what is there right now when we look at their, you know, what they actually look like in the morphology. But DNA allows us to see many things which are not related necessarily to how they live. Because one thing you might get with morphology is convergence. Like, say you have multiple animals that are, today they're diggers. Well, we know their ancestors were not both diggers, so they've convergently acquired this look. But if you just look at morphology, you can't always parse that out if you only look at living animals. So DNA can help you have a, you know, another opinion to the matter. But what the strength of morphology is there's no way to incorporate fossils without looking at the morphology, because, you know, there are some ancient DNA studies, like they've got sequences out of extinct animals like the woolly mammoth, but that's fairly limited. I think 30,000 years is the oldest they've ever attained DNA, and we were looking at some animals from, you know, 120 million years ago.
The evolution of the placental mammals came after the Cretaceous?
Yes. This has been one debate in paleontology, is when did the placental mammals radiate? You know, when did they stop just being this one lineage and then start diverging from each other in the modern orders? And if it happened before the KT extinction or after, is two very different views of mammalian evolution. And what we found was that it was after the extinction, after the orders split from each other, which shows that it was directly the extinction of the reptiles that led to the origination of the modern groups of mammals.
So the extinction of the dinosaurs led to?
Yeah, it's the idea that the mammals radiated in all these niche spaces that were not taken up by the large dinosaurs that were previously around and suddenly went out. It's not just the dinosaurs that went out. Many other groups of reptiles went extinct at the same time, and including some other groups of mammals went out. And but the placental mammals were what really radiated.
One more question about the molecular and morphological. So in this case, is the whole, adding those two, what they bring to the table, what they brought to your research, greater than the sum of the two parts?
Definitely. There's no argument that it's, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, because you can actually build it's called a total evidence study. It's the idea that you're taking everything, all that you have, and you're putting it together to help it inform one another, because you do find sometimes you get different results, different trees of life, when you combine them than you do from either running them alone. We see that there's different, gene evolution did not proceed as we previously thought.
So from the research, you're able to predict the appearance of our, and I'll say our most recent common ancestor?
Yes, and the way this works is we have this huge tree of life, and we've just zoomed in on the placental mammal part, and this is where morphology again comes into play. You know, you can just think of all placental mammals, And, you know, most of them have hair, to be very simple. Some of them don't, you know, like whales and elephants. And so, you know, one thing is like, well, did the common ancestor have hair? And by looking at how the animals are arranged on the tree and then saying, okay, well, which of the living animals have hair, you can just map down and see, okay, our most recent common ancestor had to have hair by our analysis. And of course, you know, it works for the number of teeth and, you know, even down to individual little cusps and crests on a tooth.
So that's hypothetical?
It's our current hypothesis, yes. The way we build this tree, you never actually get an animal at the node, because there's no way to actually know if a fossil is the ancestor or not. You can just say if it's closer to the ancestor or more removed.
You were talking about hair. What about body size? What about teeth? Hypothetically speaking, what does our common ancestor look like?
So we had 4,500 morphological characters, things of how they looked. And from that, we were able to, you know, body size was one of those. So we can't say exactly, you know, how much it weighed, but we can say it weighed between 6 and 245 grams. So, you know, it's fairly small, smaller than a squirrel, bigger than a shrew. It probably lived on both the trees and the ground. You know, it could run around on the ground quite well, but it could also run up to the trees to escape predators or look for food. Teeth-wise, it had a full complement of teeth. It probably ate insects. There was a reconstruction of what the animal looks like. You know, we have the tail was about as long as the body. It was plantigrade, which that means it walked like we do, and not like a dog cat does, which a dog or cat walks on its toes. We walk on the flat of our foot and things like that. We even have the sulci on the brain that it probably did have start to see some infolding on the brain's cortex, so, you know, smarter than previous mammals.
So is the tree of life, from your perspective, better filled out, a little sharper image, what?
We definitely understand the history of life better. You know, the tree of life is, you know, these focus of placental mammals. We know evolution of features such as the brain, the inner ear, and the teeth in much more detail. The broader picture is better understood in all mammalian evolution, but again, it is sharper at these little tiny features and just placement of fossil lineages.
Thank you.
It was nice to talk to you.
Michelle Spaulding of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History is a co-author of the largest mammal ancestry study ever, part of the Assembling the Tree of Life project. I'm Kevin Gavin, 90.5 WESA News.